Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Paco Romaine.
I'm George Chen.
And you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we talk documentaries chosen by our guests from the worlds of comedy, film, television, and more.
On today's episode, we sat down with comedian and writer Solomon Georgiou. Solomon has written for Adam Ruins Everything and SpongeBob SquarePants. His TV credits include Conan, The Meltdown, This Is Not Happening, Vice Lens Flophouse, and Last Call with Carson Daly. He's also got a new Comedy Central special called Homo Negro Superior.
Solomon chose to discuss 20 Feet from Stardom, directed by Morgan Neville and released in 2013. Neville was curious to know more about the lives of background singers like Darlene Love, Judith Hill, Mary Clayton, Lisa Fisher, Tata Vega, and Joe Lawrie, among many others. 20 Feet from Stardom won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature at the 86th Academy Awards.
And now here's our talk with Solomon Georgiou. And welcome to my house, Solomon Georgiou.
Hi, how's it going?
Like you met the cat, and yes. And you just came over from, I don't know where you live now.
I live in Highland Park.
You live in Highland Park.
I don't,
okay.
Not too far.
Yeah.
Do people call it HP?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. Maybe. I probably should talk to my neighbors.
You should.
I probably should be a part of my community.
I've never heard HP, but you know, I'm from the Bay Area, so we think Hewlett Packard when we hear that.
Oh, right. Or a lot of people live over there. The HP.
It is getting busy right now. It's getting very popular, and it's definitely the rent's going up. So,
mm-hmm. Oh, right.
Yeah,
I know Mark Maron. He lives over there.
Mark Maron. I believe Maria Bamford is still there as well.
Yeah. There was that Eagle Rock also is right there. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's all kind of a blend.
But yeah, it's just a lot of old houses that were very cheap at one point. So.
Mm-hmm. Not anymore.
If you got in at the right time, you got a sweet deal. But right now, no.
Do they call it
the Solomon effect? Like rents go up when you move in?
No, the white people did it. I wish I could. I really wish I had that ability to outprice a neighborhood.
I mean, I think like even back in like 2011 or 12, you could get cheap places. Over there.
Like my place is rent controlled and it's very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure they want us to move out.
Yeah.
They can make the market killing they can.
Coming from like the Bay Area where it feels like it's been like so crazy accelerated and like nonstop. I'm like everything's still like I look at prices in Highland Park. I'm like that still seems reasonable.
Oh, it's always gonna be more reasonable than San Francisco.
Yeah. That's which is like my warped view of it.
Exactly.
You know?
Like it doesn't cost like $1,000 to live in a closet.
And you used to live in Seattle for a while.
I lived
right?
in Seattle for 16 years, and I think it's actually. It's probably capital. More expensive in Seattle. It's L.A. in particular. It depends on where you want to live.
Right.
You can live in a majority of L.A. and not have to spend that crazy amount of money.
In Seattle, it's Capitol Hill was kind of like the neighborhood that probably
Seattle, I think the cost of living is like $19 an hour now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which I think is still less than San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
And so, you moved straight to L.A. from Seattle?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And then did something precipitate that, or was it just kind of like time to do
when I came to L.A.,
it was grew too big for your britches up there?
Oh, yeah, it was just there's no industry in Seattle, so that's just the way it is. And I did comedy there for 5 years before I moved down. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you become a veteran comedian after a year, you have to go to a market that... That brings
I've
you
heard
to the
this.
Bottom.
I've heard this. I mean, that's the thing with San Francisco people too. Yeah, like they all end up coming mostly. A lot of them are starting to go to New York now, though. I've seen.
I think there's always a split between the two. Mm-hmm. I think.
Well, New York's got a growing comedy scene.
Yeah,
I think it's starting to like catch on.
the
in New York, I didn't notice.
People are starting to like kind of gravitate to it because it's like new and fresh, and you can make your name there.
I didn't really consider New York as a city even until today.
It happens. Well, when you live for 16 years in Seattle, I mean, you're like, why not? I used to live in Fremont. Do you know Fremont?
Oh yeah, right near Ballard. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
I know
right
Fremont very well. There's the troll there.
There is the troll there. Yes.
Wait, I don't know this Fremont troll. You guys gotta explain that.
There's a bridge, and there's a big like there's a, under the bridge is a
it's like cement or something.
Yeah, it's cement. It's just a giant troll head and hand.
Oh, nice.
So you can literally hang out with the troll under the bridge if you want.
Paco, when did you live in that area?
I lived there in 1996 for like 5 months, and I couldn't take it. I had to get out.
Oh, well, did you move in the middle of the winter?
No, I was there during the summer, but like there was just there was just too many white people. Like I couldn't handle like all, especially where I was living.
Yeah,
I wanted some diversity.
Of course,
I moved from Michigan to Seattle. And also, like, I had this crazy job where I was biking in a coffee shop around with my buddy. It was called Espresso A Go-Go, and it was like this.
20 years too attached. Early. 20 years too early for that idea.
Two bikes attached to this, like, giant coffee shop.
Wow.
And we would go to the bridge, and then we would go on one side at 8 in the morning and the other side at 5 p.m., and then we would sell coffee and stuff. And so, but anyway, we're not here to talk about my time in Seattle.
Yeah.
Not entirely. But you picked 20 Feet from Stardom.
Yes.
The award-winning documentary.
Yes.
Why'd you gravitate towards this? This one?
Because I like the, a lot of documentaries tend to just focus on just sadness. consistently, this one I like hopeful ending documentaries that like shine a light on things that aren't appreciated, and this I think was fantastic. It was there's all these background singers who literally should be solo singers because they're better than the people that they're singing for.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah,
yeah, no, it's like especially like with like the one that always stuck out for me was Mary Clayton, in the documentary, and how her voice is absolutely bananas, and she's a background singer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she is awesome.
Yeah.
I love Mary Clayton, and her story is about singing in the Raylettes, right? Mm-hmm. Raylettes. I mean, I can't even imagine being in and near Ray Charles, but let alone being in his band and being one of his backup singers. She's incredible, and she like I like how she was just like she's like I'm a diva, so
yeah, you
know. Yeah, I think there is, you're right, like this sort of feel good nature. I was looking at like I was surprised I didn't know that this had won the Oscar, and I was thinking about like it's so not like a typical thing that would win the Oscar because it is kind of like triumphal in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's sort of like this regret that runs through the whole thing. I think there's a lot of regret.
Yeah.
But it's still like, you know, about art. So
and getting even like they're still like, even though I'm background, I still got a chance to do what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I usually like when I'm, it's very hard to get me to watch most documentaries. I'm like, why aren't you guys doing anything to save these people? Why are you just putting
a camera
to their face?
Yeah, put the
Go
camera
and
down.
Do something.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no one to save in this situation. It's all like, well, I was thinking about it, like there was no villain, right? There is like just like indifference
just
the industry, which is a huge villain.
Well, with Darlene Love, there is a villain,
right? That's true. There is Phil Spector.
Phil Spector is her villain. She was trapped with him,
but it, like she seems even now pretty gracious about it. Like she still has like she won't really talk too much smack about him.
Well, he's in jail now.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, like, he's done worse things to himself, right?
Yeah, yeah, she's like, oh, at least he didn't murder me like he did his wife.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. I was watching that Pacino version of that Phil Spector story. It was on HBO. Did you guys see that at all?
Yeah.
It's not, I fell asleep during it. It was really hard to get through.
David
Mamet wrote it. It's all about, like, the defense attorneys.
Yeah, I'm not going to watch that. That sounds very hard to watch.
Yeah, like... Just the justification of like, is I don't know. It was pretty bad, but he gets really upset when someone brings up Ronnie Spector.
Because they weren't they married?
Ronnie Spector was married. Yeah,
yes.
He was married.
And
it's the same last name.
She kept the last name too, I believe. Yeah. She still has the same last name. Even like they divorced in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe even before that.
I saw her once. I saw Ronnie Spector, yeah. I saw her, I want to say, in like 1999, like my first time going to New York. I went to like CMJ, and she had put out a record on Kill Rock Stars.
Hmm.
Who like we always have people from Kill Rock Stars on the show. And she had put out this one record on Kill Rock Stars and performed live, and it was pretty awesome. I got to see her perform.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
I don't know that she's done much live music since then. But
I don't know.
I mean, I was thinking the other day that she still must be making money off that Eddie Money song.
Take Me Home Tonight?
Yeah, you get like some performance royalties for that.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's just the smallest amount of singing from her.
Yeah. But that's also like the type of background singing we talk about in this movie. It's just like the hook that everyone knows is usually the background.
Yeah,
all the hook.
Like the Gimme Shelter. That is... Like the Rolling Stones have great hooks, but that one is literally not them singing the biggest part of the song.
No, like the most memorable part of the song. Yeah. Like which is like actually we should just play a clip of that, and that's is that who's doing that?
It's Mary Clayton that's singing that, and that's the best thing about this story I loved was that they called her up in the middle of the night while she was pregnant wearing curlers.
Right.
And she just goes to the studio and just rips out that insane vocal.
Yeah. And it's not only was she pregnant and it's 4 a.m. and she has curlers in there, but when she gets there, they hand her the lyrics and it's like rape. Murder.
I never knew that was the line of that song until I heard
it. And she had to wail it. Like
Like
a guttural.
So it was like very late at night, and I was very, you know, a little pregnant. Had curlers and the whole thing in my head, getting ready to go to bed. And we got a call, Mary, there's a group of guys in town called the Rolling Somebodies, and they're from England, and they need somebody that will sing with them.
I mean, she just did it like a couple of times, you know.
So I said to myself, I'm going to do another one. I'm going to blow them out of this room. I went in again, and I did that pass on the part that says, Ray Murder, just a shot away. So I had to go up another octave.
Ray Murder, it's just a shot away. It's just a shot away. Ray Murder, yeah. It's just a shot away. It's just a shot away. Ray Murder, it's just a shot.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Watching this, like George and I were talking before we started recording about like the similarities of background singers and like just the entertainment business and being comics, you know, like and just because you have lots of talent doesn't mean you're going to make it. You're going to be a star, you know.
It's true.
And we have seen that. At least I know in my career, I've seen really talented people who've just like quit because they're like, I can't even get a hosting job at a club. You know,
So I think the gatekeepers are different, though. Yeah, it's different types of gatekeepers between the music industry and comedy.
Yeah, but they sort of function in a very similar way.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, that is one of the things with comedy because like we all tend to have this idea of being a star because we're by ourselves on stage,
right?
And we don't think like there's a compromise between being a star and doing comedy. You can do this forever and not have to be the biggest star in the world.
Yeah,
and that's. And that's those were, like, especially in the documentary, those were the people I enjoyed the most, were the ones that were like, if I get a solo career, great, but I have a job and I'm going to keep doing it till the day I die. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's fucking awesome, but it's awesome. Must be like so...
The getting close part must be the worst.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, like, when I think of Lisa Fisher,
yeah,
who is like kind of... I think the people that stick out a lot to me, mm-hmm, Lisa Fisher and like Darlene Love stick out, mm-hmm, a lot in this, and they kind of have these more arcs to their story. Because she had that moment where she got the record deal. She put out the record, and then the follow-up record just didn't happen.
Yep.
And she even doesn't seem to totally know why.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, it's not just like one villain. It's just, it is like the corporation or the music industry as a whole.
Yeah, the music industry as a whole. But there's also the, like, if you're just a pure singer and song choice is, that's the hardest thing that I've always feel bad about some amazing singers, because I'm like, if you don't know how to select songs yourself, mm-hmm, and you are convinced easily to sing a certain song, yeah, you need to do better.
Yeah.
There's been so many albums, like, a lot of people lose on the second album because the second album has terrible songwriting, mm-hmm, and that, like, it doesn't matter what your vocals are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I think, like, this, the younger person here, I think, was a Judith Hill. She, mm-hmm, does originals, and I think writing your own song seems like it's important. But then all these people, like, you know, all the big top 10 people, like, most of them aren't writing their own stuff at this point in time. Like, I know, Linda Perry from Four Non Blondes writes a lot of stuff for people. Like, she wrote for Pink and things, mm-hmm, like that.
Yeah, it's that's how a lot of the musicians that are either they're very good at writing their own songs or, mm-hmm, they affiliate themselves with the best songwriters in the industry. Mm-hmm. And like C is also one, mm-hmm, that's like, I can write my own songs and I can write 100 songs for 100 other pop singers.
Yo.
And that's how you maintain a long career.
Yeah. Like, you could be a joke writer that writes jokes for other comedians.
That's still comedy. That's the thing, is like working on like the idea, like, people always freak out with comedy. They're like, I'm not gonna make it if I get this job where I'm writing comedy all day. I'm like, well, you're still doing the thing,
right? Yeah, like, there's different ways it can permutate. Yeah.
I don't know. To me, that sounds like making it.
it
my
is
priorities
it.
Are screwed. Yeah, I'm like, you're getting a paycheck to do comedy.
Yeah,
that's making it. My viewpoint.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you could have do the other things that don't involve comedy.
Yeah.
Why? Right.
Was Claudia Lanier the one that had like she did her solo record and she kept touring on it and just didn't take? I think that was Claudia Lanier.
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was multiple people in this story.
Yeah, I think that it was like multiple.
That was
like,
multiple people's story.
Mm-hmm. I think the only ones with like Darlene Love had the most successful solo career,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, especially with that Christmas song.
Yeah,
which is one of the most popular songs every year.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
was she the one that would go on
Letterman?
Yeah, she performed the song every year. I think it's just called "Christmas Time" is the name of the song.
Right.
Or I can't remember.
Everyone knows that song. Yeah, but also that was another Phil Spector thing, right? Because she kept getting her name. It was attributed to the Crystals all the, mm-hmm, time. They would, like, he would record her and then tell her it was going to come out as her solo record, and then she'd hear it on the radio.
Oh, he did that with multiple, like, he did that with her voice with multiple other groups. Like, she would be singing the song, mm-hmm, and he would just replace it with a different face, and she would, because he didn't want her to out of the studio.
Yeah.
No, she was in the worst contract. That was pretty much the worst thing ever.
There's so many bad contracts. I mean, they're still to this day, but I think, like, even before, imagine before the internet, you really couldn't, like, unless you had, like, a good lawyer, you didn't know what kind of thing.
So I don't even, like, technically she's on this, they say she's a background singer, but she was a lead singer. Like, she was just not not the lead singer in concert. She was literally the one lead singing in the radio hit.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, like, what I wonder what they got paid, what she would get paid for a session fee versus what she would have made if people had known that was her single.
Yeah.
It would have been so much more because what now, like, she loses royalties, like, mm-hmm, if she's not the face of the group. So she's just getting paid by sessions. So now she's trapped and going doing sessions again. So otherwise she won't get any more money.
I know a little bit about this because there was this big thing about people getting performance royalties from before 1972. Mm-hmm. And like that was like, there was a law that like with the cutoff date was 72. I think they just changed the law, so you couldn't get performance royalties before 72. So they had to go back in and renegotiate all of this with all these musicians. And like that's like when most of the greatest music was made.
And that's only fair, you know, before 72. Like, that's the because the other documentary I mentioned was Standing in the Shadows of Motown, mm-hmm. and it's about the Funk Brothers. And it's the group that pretty much did all the music for Motown.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they literally they did not get any money off of that whatsoever.
That's insane.
Like just
and some of the, like James Jamerson, some of those guys are some of the best musicians mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. And they're not getting any money for that stuff. That's insane.
Like if they can backpedal that so they can get some royalties for the best music ever made.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. It's like you just have that option there of like you have money here, I can pay you this much now
mm-hmm.
versus a percentage later. And sometimes people just either they don't have the option to they don't really know what they're giving up, and I think that's most of the time what was happening back then.
Yeah. But yeah, luckily that's one thing is that you can still have that ability for the rest of your life, but damn, that just sucks.
Yeah, to lose out on that.
It's just a shitty thing. I feel bad. Oh, some people deserve real money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially with like world-class talent, like Darlene Love. Mm-hmm. And she seems so amazing. Like she's still, there's that point where she's listening to that playback and she's like, she was what? I think she said she was 15 and now she's 70.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. You know? Yeah. With her group. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whole life.
That's a whole fucking life. And she looks amazing, too. That's the other thing. Mm-hmm. I like, she looks like she's 40. That's incredible.
You definitely the aging process in old British men versus...
Oh, yeah. Every one of those background stars just looking amazing. And then they show the rock stars. They're just wheeling them in.
She was a hotbed back then. Like, no, she still looks way better than you.
And she was the same age as you, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Some cases, she's older.
I mean, I was struck by the choice of the beginning of this to start with the Lou Reed and mm-hmm. Take a Walk on the Wild Side. And then they just kind of, like, immediately go into, like... Because I grew up knowing that song and being like... this doesn't seem generationally like what you would say. The Color Girls say "do to do," but and then they just launch right into it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's sort of like baked into the entire premise. There was this weird fetishization that the British,
they
had with American like blues.
Well, it's because they all base it off of they're all inspired by blues
mm-hmm.
and jazz and soul music, and when they ability to get soul singers to sing the chorus,
mm-hmm.
that's
it.
And I think like even though they're still in the lead, like I think like every one of those famous white musicians were all very like super appreciative
mm-hmm.
of like they spoke highly of every background singer.
Right, they acknowledge that like that's what makes a song. Yeah. Right, even.
I think they acknowledge that they're the better talents too. Like mm-hmm. they're like, you guys are.
That's the thing. Like in a movie like this, it's like Sting can sit back and be like, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to success in this industry. I'm like, you're fucking Sting. Yeah. Like it's just kind of annoying hearing it come out of this successful white dude.
Well, that's the thing is that when they say the rhyme or reason, they're like, oh, I forgot that how this plays out.
Yeah.
It's like, there's no rhyme or reason for success in this career. Now let's go back to all of these black women.
Yeah. Versus the British white guy who decided to play reggae in like the 80s, right? Yeah.
I see a pattern. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, like that's sort of like the subtext under mm-hmm. all this, but they don't really pound on it very hard. I mean,
they don't
it's there
pound
to be
on
picked
it.
On, and it's there for the taking. But
yeah, but
not.
I think it was this one, like as much as like the racial point is obvious, I think it was mostly about highlighting the singers and their ability,
mm-hmm.
which I think is like the better outcome is people mm-hmm. like generally appreciating what this is instead of like, oh, this is a Rolling Stones song. Well, this Rolling Stones song also has Mary Clayton fucking nailing it down. Mm-hmm. Or it has Darlene, or like this Phil Spector song is Darlene Love that and she's in the background and no one's giving. It's like, that's the kind of stuff that I think is important.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's the stuff I love is stuff in music where people are like, I should know what this is. And like, when I, like after this, I immediately got Mary Clayton's solo album.
Uh-huh.
And she did
it. Oh, nice.
She has her own cover of Gimme Shelter on it.
Oh, nice.
And it is pretty phenomenal.
And like
I was going to ask you if there's anyone after you watched this doc, was there someone you hadn't heard of that you went out and you know wanted to check them out?
That was her. That was like I did not like I didn't put two and two together. I just assumed that was just this all the songs that she was a part of that I didn't really think of her. And when it was like, once you put a face to a voice, I'm like, yeah, I gotta go. I want to hear this voice more.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I felt the same way about Tata Vega.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
After watching.
Oh
this.
Yes.
Like I love gospel. I love gospel music, and I really want to hear more from Lisa Fisher and Tata Vega. Like her voice, man, and like what you're saying about the like bands and their songs and then the hooks and having the background singers sing the hook, it's like it brings that emotion to that song. It brings that like visceral emotion and feeling that you don't really get, like, especially from someone like Sting, you know, who needs a kick in the ass in the emotion department. Mm-hmm. Anyways, you know, that's that intangible talent that like that you won't have unless you have someone who can fucking bring that, you know, each and every time. And a lot of these girls, like a lot of these women, they have those, that sequence where like, well, where'd you get your start? And it was like church, mm-hmm. daughter of a pastor, church, you know?
Oh yeah.
And
that's one of my favorite, like a friend of mine said he wanted to make his voice more soulful. And he was like he compared himself to like what, like he was trying to figure out how to get like a big, and he went to a vocalist and he was like, well, did you have to start singing at a church when you're 4 years old?
Right. Start belting that stuff out.
Otherwise you're never going to be able to sing like that.
No.
Butterfly effect your voice. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And did you grow up going to any churches?
My churches were boring. I went to Ethiopian Orthodox churches, very humdrum.
Ethiopian
not a lot
Orthodox.
Of singing in that?
Very similar to Greek Orthodox.
Okay.
Like not a lot of crazy singing, a lot of the incense in a
right.
It's very gothic. It's mm-hmm. very mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dreary.
Yes.
So, is your family
you guys
were really
singing
into it that?
Were there choirs singing Smith songs?
Oh, I wish. That would have been more lively. No, the Ethiopian ones, there wasn't any singing. But we also went to Greek Orthodox churches where there was singing. So it was a very slow, boring, like hymns.
And you, this is when you came to, you ended up in Fresno? Or?
We lived in Fresno for 7 years before Seattle. Uh-huh. Seattle we moved into 1994. But we went to a lot of different churches. And,
was there a large Ethiopian community in Fresno?
There was for some weird reason, there was an Ethiopian community in Fresno for a bit. Oh, it's gone now because everyone's like, scatter! Get out of Fresno! Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, so that's when we moved. Like, there's now one in Seattle, there's one in San Francisco.
Yeah, Oakland has
a good one. There's one here now, too. But
oh, yeah, down on off Fairfax, mm-hmm. yeah.
Fairfax and also Pasadena has a community, too.
Sorry?
Pasadena?
Okay.
Yeah, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. I don't like the places that I can go to. I should check out.
Right. That's where that stuff's happening. Go ahead, George.
There's a lot of Greek Orthodox in Fresno, or is that more of a
thing? There is actually, there was a big Greek community in Fresno. There was like the weatherman there, the local weatherman. Mm-hmm. He went to my church and he was Greek. And I think they're Greek, Armenians, and I think like it's Vietnamese, and those are the three main groups. Other than mm-hmm. Other than white and black, which mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but everyone has a fair chance to get addicted to cocaine and to crack and meth there. So
right,
in
it's an equal playing field.
Equal playing field. Choose your drug of choice in this shithole of a city. Beautifully diverse.
Did you play? Were you a musician growing up?
Oh no, I tried to, but everything required practice,
right.
which really big problem for me.
Because I don't know if you ever tried like writing a hook or not.
Oh, I've written songs before.
Oh yeah,
I'm a terrible singer, but I sing here and there, and I had a show here where we did songs. And we just, they were weird. They were funny. was I a good singer in them? No.
Who'd you run the show with?
Greg Edwards and Brody Reed.
Okay.
You guys are familiar with Greg Edwards.
Yeah. He's been on the show. Yeah. We need to get Brody on, too. Do you guys like have to improvise a song on the spot, or people came in with their songs?
No, we jammed out before and then like just threw together songs, and then we performed them. Some of them went really well. Some of them were like, nope, you guys didn't want that? We get it.
And you used to live with Josh Androsky, too, yes, right? He's a huge karaoke dude.
I love karaoke. I do that all the time.
Yeah. What are your karaoke tunes?
My go-tos are Harry Belafonte, Jumpin' the Line, Lionel Richie, All Night Long, and Under the Sea from The Little Mermaid.
Oh, wow. Those are some slow jams.
Mm-hmm. Just the Caribbean sounds.
Yes, they are the Caribbean sounds.
It's the easiest register for me to sing in without straining my voice, so it's the trick that I have up my sleeve.
Should we try All Night Long right now?
Oh, no.
Three, two. No, I'm joking.
Fiesta forever.
George and I can be your backup singers.
Oh, no, I'm not going to do it. It's. I'm not going to. That's the thing, is that I have to hear it, and I don't want to hear it.
Yeah. I always feel like the karaoke songs are always a little out of the key that I'm used to singing, and a little faster than I remember the song ever being.
Well, the songs definitely have to be faster, because no one needs to be tortured. I think, like, there's nothing wrong with your voice, but there are terrible singers out there, and the full length of the song is a painful thing to do.
Right. No, my voice is definitely painful, and it is. So next time you're in Oakland, mm-hmm. if you ever come to Oakland, whatever, there's a place called Melody. It's a bar. It's a karaoke bar in Oakland, like mm-hmm. outer sides of Oakland, and they have two dudes that sing backup on every song.
Really?
Yeah. So when you go sing your song, these two dudes are standing there with microphones, and they know every karaoke song, apparently, because they have steps, they have moves they make, like synchronized moves and stuff, and they will sing backup with you.
This is West Oakland?
And it's in West Oakland. Okay.
That
yeah.
sounds awesome.
Okay.
And it's awesome. It's an older bar. I'm talking about clientele.
Mm-hmm.
Older, like middle class black couples and like Asian couples and like dudes that like look like they work at UPS and stuff. Like, it's not like fancy at all, and it's awesome. It's a great place. It's called Melody.
Wow, I gotta mm-hmm. check it out.
I thought you were gonna say that piano bar Rod Dibble off of a Grant. Did you know about? Have you been to that one ever?
No.
Yeah, the Alley, I believe it's called. Yeah.
I think I've only been to the Mint.
Oh, for karaoke? Yeah, yeah, the Mint is good.
And I know there's another one not in near Union.
Yeah, there's a few. I mean, there's also the phenomenon of the private room, mm-hmm. which I'm not a fan of the private room. I prefer the Mint type setup.
Yeah.
Because private room, you're paying up the ass, and then you don't have that weird interaction with strangers.
Yeah, I want to
show off.
I want to shine. I'm a showman. I'm a performer. I'm not here to sing by myself in a room. Mm-hmm. I could do that at home.
Mm-hmm. Give me a couple two-tree gin and tonics, and I'm ready to go.
Well, also, like, it's one of those things where it's like you can just make a private room karaoke in your own house. So you don't have to.
This is true.
You don't have to go out for that.
The Mint is like professional, though, man. People bring their own CDs and stuff.
Oh, really? Wow, like, do they?
Yeah, they hand them to the DJ. Like, they bring their own stuff, man. Like, I can't mix it up with professional karaoke people. Yeah.
I like having someone sing really well, and then having me follow it, and still getting the same reaction from the audience. It's like, oh, you did such a good job with your singing voice. Well, I'm not gonna do that good, but I'm definitely gonna outshine you as a performer.
Yes. Yeah. George, do you have a go-to karaoke song?
I used to do. I've done The Candyman by Sammy Davis Jr. It's a weird one.
That's a fun one.
I like to do the weird ones.
That's awesome.
I'll go weird. I tend to go weird. Oh, actually, my legit song I always do is Squeeze Up the Junction, because that's really wordy, and it actually, like, the ascending notes are very strange, but it's like a really emotional song. Do you guys know that one?
I don't know it at all.
No. We can edit it into the outro.
So we can hear it, yeah.
Me singing Up the Junction, specifically, no. I don't know if that would be that great. But I've actually hosted karaoke before.
Oh, that's dangerous.
Like an art kind of setting. Like, I did it for the Thing Quarterly. They did this party in the Tenderloin, and they had me be the KJ, which was not really. It's my first time doing it. But that meant when people were too embarrassed or afraid and like uptight in like an art setting to actually sing, then I would just sing just to fill the space, like a KJ is supposed to do, like just to take that turn to like get people to think, oh, I can do this, and this asshole's doing this. So that's usually not how it goes.
But. Right. But that's like 100 feet from stardom.
It's 6 feet below stardom.
Yeah. me and a friend bombarded somebody with karaoke once.
Mm-hmm.
My friend owned a bar in Seattle, and like it was like a dead night there. So she was like, "Do you want to sing karaoke?" And I was like, "Well, you don't have a karaoke setup." So we just took her laptop and set up a microphone. And the bartender, who was just like, "Oh, I get to go home early tonight," and we were like, "No, we're gonna sing karaoke at you
for you." Just
and
for you.
Like 45 minutes in, he like eventually broke down and started singing with us.
Oh man,
that's funny.
So I've never been to Smog Cutter, but I heard they just shut down.
Oh yes, that one is a fun one. It is an uncoverable space. There's not very much room, but it is a shame that they got shut down.
But their open mic was the same night as mine, so now mine will do better. Maybe
I didn't know there was an open mic there.
I think there was a Thursday open mic at Smog Cutter that was people talked about. Yeah, I never went.
I should be attentive to where the open mics are.
Well,
I'm very bad at it.
Yeah.
Well,
after
you're doing pretty
point,
well right now. I mean, you just had an album come out.
I get it.
Come out.
But jokes are better when you do them in front of comedians that don't give a shit.
Yes. It always feels great
when
you leave a really good open mic. You just feel like this is the career I was meant to have.
This is what I want to do forever.
Forever.
Where did you record your special? Was it Portland?
Oh, yeah. I went to Mississippi Studios.
Okay. I've never been there. I've heard about it.
It's a phenomenal... Kill Rockstars also does a lot of stuff there, too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's an amazing setup. 200 seats, so it's nice and intimate.
Mm-hmm.
The sound people are the best thing in the world. I was so amazed by what they did because I felt like I was mumbling half the time because there was a little bit of nerves, and I was like, oh, that sounds really clear. You guys are great at your job.
Did you think about doing it down here or doing it in Seattle? Or
I definitely wasn't going to do it here. LA.
What is the drawback of doing it in LA? I guess a lot of people like to do theirs outside of LA.
It's like the LA audience is fairly particular. Mm-hmm. So it's
they're like smilers, right?
They're smilers. Exactly. There's a lot of industry, and the thing is I was thinking of Seattle, that I was like, I'll do Portland, where it's going to be an audience that doesn't entirely know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like. Because as much as I love my friends, I know that they're going to give me the big reaction. And I was like, I want a genuine audience. I want I want people that are there to specifically, like, I'm here to see comedy, not to automatically laugh when you hit a punchline.
Support, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was a mistake I made. I did one set. I recorded just one set, and I did it in my hometown.
Yeah.
Both bad ideas. It's, and I also use my own comedy, so.
Oh, Paco.
Right there.
Come on.
If that was an indication, I don't see what could have gone wrong.
But yeah, I love my friends. I do very much. But there's a different interaction I have with an audience of mostly my friends and an audience of mostly strangers.
I love Portland for comedy. I've had great times just fucking around in Portland. It's
very relaxed. It's very, very smart. Very good lappers.
I think you should have on your next album backup singers singing your punchlines.
Oh man,
with you.
If I could, I would. I would easily do it. I could just like layer my voice,
or just book Lisa Fisher to just like call.
Oh my god!
Oh
jokes.
Man, that would be.
She's like, "Am I right?
Yeah, right.
What's up with stuff?"
Oh, that would be fun. I will actually. It's a good idea. I'm gonna take it.
That would be awesome, dude. Backup singer singing the punch would be that. Oh, singing the punch. Okay.
Singing the punch.
Singing the punch. Where someone write this down. Someone record this
right now.
We'll edit all of this out.
Record the recording.
Record
all of this.
Working with Michael really did inspire me. and saying like, wow, it's okay to dream this big. It's okay to realize your dreams. I still believe
someday you'll come around. She's representational of what's happening with background singers at this point. I know that she aspires to be a solo artist, though. I'll pray.
This last tour, I heard from other friends that were with Michael that he just loved her. And of course she got the job.
You know, we were so excited for him and for us to be able to do this show, and it was coming together. And
I can't do that. But you're fine to do it. I gotta save my voice. I ain't going nowhere.
And then all of a sudden, we're on our way to rehearsal, and we get the news, and it's like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, how's that even possible? Such an overwhelming shock just to go from almost on our way to this huge show to all of a sudden, he's gone.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Solomon,
yes.
Are you a fan of female jazz singers?
I'm a fan of a couple. I just don't think I've dwelled too deep in it. Ella Fitzgerald and Betsy Smith are about as much as I can
sure.
as I know of. Billie Holiday as well.
Sure. And well, those are the classics.
And Lena Horne.
I mean, Lena.
Yeah.
You gotta love Lena.
But
Ella, you can't go wrong with Ella.
What kind of music did your parents grow up listening to?
It's a lot of Ethiopian music. Ethiopian music is more versatile. There is Ethiopian jazz.
I actually have a bunch of Ethiopian records, and like there's some artists I really like from there was like these reissues that came out in the early 2000s, like the Ethiopeaks compilations.
Oh yes.
With like the jazz like a funk band that was all made of policemen, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
That
stuff's
yeah.
great.
It's a very strong music scene out there. And I think like my dad is a musician.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He actually, there's this very specific Ethiopian instrument. It's like a stand-up guitar, but it's like one string. And you just move your fingers down and you have a bow. And my dad, he built his own.
Whoa.
We got to watch a goat die for it.
Wait, is there goat skin on?
Yeah,
on the
base
it?
Is the base. A wooden like a wooden
okay.
Hollow box.
Okay.
With
one string.
So yeah, one
plucked,
string.
But it's bowed,
the,
yeah.
But, yeah, the base is wrapped in the goat skin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
And he plays with ensembles of people.
No, he was
just
at home
totally
playing
solo,
by
yeah.
himself.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had musical inclinations as a youth, but they were squandered and.
Yeah.
He just stared at his kids, wondering how he felt.
You're one of how many?
I'm one of seven.
One of seven.
But my dad, only four of us are from my father.
Okay. Because you have the story about stealing the video game. With
oh,
your
yeah,
brother.
Yeah. So my mother, yeah.
yeah. One of your, so I'm like, I didn't know how many brothers you had, but yeah.
It's five boys altogether, two girls. Eldest brother never came to America. So
oh, really? Stayed
yeah.
over there?
Mm-hmm. He was like 15.
Have you been there?
Yeah, but it's like nothing to write
adult,
home about.
In your adult time?
It's been not as an adult. No. It's been a long time.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. I'm just curious about
that. I can go. I should. But there's no one making me, so.
Right, if you still have. I was just looking at this DVD cover, and even though we're talking about like how these people didn't get to be, they were not the spotlight people, like this DVD still uses all the big name people to sell the DVD.
Of course.
It's
that's
like,
what it does.
Hey, featuring Bruce Springsteen, Sting, Mick Jagger, Stevie Wonder, and Bette Midler praising these other people that
we're not going to name right up front.
Because they're 20 feet from stardom. I mean, it is a pretty apt title when you think about it. You know, you spend your entire career just being like, God damn it. Like, I'm a lot more talented than that fucker. Yeah. I'm back here.
I love those siblings.
But there are success stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Mariah Carey started off as a background singer for Pebbles, I think. Okay. Or no, not Pebbles. Oh, God, I used to know what this is, and I feel so bad. Luther Vandross was on this.
Yeah,
he's a background
Luther
singer.
Started.
Oh, yeah.
Sheryl Crow is in here. Mm-hmm. She started as a background.
They gave one of my favorite quotes, probably my favorite quote from this documentary is attributed to Luther Vandross. Do you guys remember that quote?
I'm not sure which one you're thinking of.
Sweating like a pig, singing like an angel.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Because she was talking about how like he would wear three-piece suits when he first started.
Oh, when he's backing up Bowie. Like, that's right. Yeah. He's backing up Bowie and Young Americans. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, he'd sweating like a pig, singing like an angel. I'm like, oh, man, that's awesome. I love Luther. You guys are big Luther fans?
I need to be more familiar with his work. I'm a little out of touch with it. I don't know why.
Yeah, well, it happens. It happens.
Yeah, this
is just like
even music. I don't listen to these. Basically, I only hear the Rolling Stones when I watch a Scorsese movie. So it's like unelectively, yeah. Or when we did Gimme Shelter or something. But yeah, this isn't usually the area I get into, but there's no denying like the sheer range and vocal ability of these people. So, yeah.
No, my I also have the issue of not listening to very many male singers. So it's usually a lot of female vocalists in my playlists.
Mm-hmm. Like who's your favorite?
Oh, of all time, it's gonna be Tina Turner.
Oh, yeah. She's in here. Yeah.
I think she's my favorite voice of all time. I think it's...
Oh, interesting.
It's just something insanely guttural and, like, incomparable to other voices. I think there's, like, 9 versions of River Deep, Mountain High, and I love each and every single one of them.
Oh, it's creepy seeing... Yeah, it's creepy seeing Ike in this, just kind of, like, glaring from behind the guitar. Oh, like, they're like, oh, he was like a pimp. He treated all the women in the band like he owned them, so...
The iCats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have one fact about the iCats that I... on Roseanne, there was the... When she was working at the restaurant, and there was a big blonde woman that she was working with. Like, with stringy blonde hair, like platinum blonde.
I guess maybe my Roseanne is... I'm not... I know
she was on
the
for a couple of seasons. Yeah. It was only a couple of seasons, and... But she, I wish I remember the lady's name because she was the first and only ever white Iquette.
Okay.
Oh, weird.
And she just ended up being on Roseanne for a couple of seasons. And I have no idea what her career was like between those two. So I just kind of figured, I just want to know.
Yeah. That reminds me of like seeing Darlene Love in Lethal Weapon.
Oh,
I did not remember that she was married to Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon.
Right.
She did everything. She had a big career, yeah.
She's awesome, man. I think she's... I didn't realize she was in Lethal Weapon. Where did you see that?
In the doc. Yeah. It's in the doc. They just show her, like, she's like...
It's very brief.
One of the things she did. Oh, my, you know, my weird showbiz... My IMDb credit I have is this documentary and Lethal Weapon.
That's hilarious. Yeah. I liked how Lisa Fisher, who apparently doesn't, like, stay in her apartment very often because she's working so much. But when she's like, I haven't had time to put up my gold albums yet. And she's like flipping
her
through her gold albums. Her Grammys that are on the floor and stuff.
She won a Grammy in like 90, right? Is that's in the doc, right? She's performing at the Grammys or she won a Grammy? Yeah.
Well, I think she has multiple Grammys because she was on a song that got a Grammy. So you automatically get a Grammy for that too.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, that... Yeah, that's pretty insane when you don't have enough time to put up your gold albums. Mm-hmm. You know, when you don't spend enough, that's when you're really working. I think that's when you gotta have a career.
Oh yeah,
that's when you know you have a career.
And then yeah, like at the end, it's revealed that she is also like the person who now sings "Gimme Shelter" with the Rolling Stones.
Yes,
because
she did,
she's
yeah.
always touring with them and has been since like the early '90s. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's weird how like some of them view it as a little bit of a trap to do it, like. Like one of the younger people, like Judith Hill is this younger person who she's like, oh, I did this thing with Kylie Minogue and I thought my friends wouldn't notice it. But then I started getting like messages mm-hmm. like, what are you doing on like TV with Kylie Minogue? So like it's sort of like she wants to be a solo artist, but she's like, I'm not going to turn down this gig singing with Kylie Minogue. I wouldn't turn that down.
Yeah, I don't think you should do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, solo artist makes sense, but no one's out there like, I saw you as a background singer and I cannot appreciate your own music now. Yeah, that'd be a weird turn of events.
I feel like there's this thing of like, if someone might watch this and think that there's this, they keep talking about like, oh, you need a certain amount of ego, you need a certain amount of like wanting to be in the limelight and to be one of those
yeah.
people. And then some people are all about the actual craft or the singing. Mm-hmm. But then that also kind of makes it seem like, well, they just didn't want it hard enough. I'm like, the people yeah. here, they worked and they wanted it. And like it was just trends in the industry. Or even like when they were scrolling through all the photos of all the records that background people or backup right. singers had done. And it's like Patty Austin. Like, I know who Patty Austin is. Like, Patty Austin's like a name. I mean, you see her in the cutout bins, but you see Lionel Richie in the cutout bins. Yeah. You see all these people in the cutout bins now. So it's hard to... I keep kind of hinging back to that because like we're all artists trying to make things happen mm-hmm. for ourselves. And like, have you taken a writing gig?
I have, yes.
Yeah, you've done writing gigs. And it doesn't... It's just like another tool in your mm-hmm. arsenal, really. But it's like if your goal was like, no, I need to be one of the top 10 comedians that tours like and makes a living doing stand up,
yeah.
that would be really limiting.
It is limiting. Well, yeah, that's just that limits like that's such a big goal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't reach it, you're going to beat yourself up way harder mm-hmm. than having a lower level goal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also think of it this thing of like all these people, they're more respected by the Mick Jaggers
yep.
and the Stings and right. the Bette Midlers and whatnot. And that is kind of like the people we know who are talented, who haven't like made it, like a comics comic, for mm-hmm. example.
Oh yeah, the people
that's
that
the
we
thing
know.
That
yeah,
we
yeah.
know. Yeah, it's kind of constantly that, and I'm like I would say, like I always mention like Ron Lynch to people. I'm like, mm-hmm. Ron Lynch could be like a way better known person, but he sort of operates in this zone of like all the other people that are in comedy like respect him.
Oh yeah,
so it's like. What's better in the long? I'm like, I'm sure he would love to like get a special or something, mm-hmm. but it's like that's just the zone that he's been in for a while.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, and that's the path he chose, though. You know, I think right, or is that wrong?
Well, I don't know. I can't speak for him.
I mean, not for yeah. specifically for him, but like just for someone like this niche of like being that person that all the other people look up to, but mm-hmm. you're not like
yeah.
widely. Commercially known.
Yeah.
Right. Man, I would have no problems being an unknown writer on a hit sitcom. I'd have no problems with that, you know?
I'm fine with being an unknown writer on a, not even a hit sitcom, just a sitcom.
Right. There's also that. Let's just keep it a just unknown writer.
Yeah.
Those are the sites I'm setting at this point.
What are some of the writing gigs that you've been doing?
I've done SpongeBob SquarePants and mm-hmm.
oh, cool.
and Adam Ruins Everything.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, I'm in the shift of what I'll be doing from here on out. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I'm currently actively auditioning and doing things and. One of these things will stick, and I'll be like, "Fine, I'm doing this for a while." Mm-hmm.
Right.
Is it gonna be more like acting type stuff, or?
I do love performing more. Mm-hmm. As much as I enjoy writing, performing is the better of the two for me. But I'm not gonna die if I don't. Mm-hmm. So I'm okay with either one. But that's, yeah, it's sort of it's it's kind of a thing where you have 100 fucking irons in the fire and you're just waiting for one to go off. But that's it.
Have you gotten a lot of good response with the specials and stuff?
It's been a great response. Mm-hmm. It's been effectively a wonderful situation, and a lot of people want to meet with me now. Mm-hmm. And
you just did Conan again, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
So I can't complain. Yeah. It's just right now is making sure I select the thing that I want to do for a long period of time and be happy. Right.
You have more options now. Yeah. So
that's awesome. Have you written like a comedy show about yourself?
Oh, of course. That's the first thing we all do. But I'm also, I am currently pitching something. But I'm also fine with as much as that is my goal, I can happily take 3 levels down below that very, very happy.
Have you ever gotten caught one of those things where you find out you're up for something and people are like, there's no way he'd want to do that. Like, it's below his goal sets or something. Yeah. Have you ever had that?
I'm not aware of it.
Well, yeah, maybe you wouldn't find out.
Yeah, I think that's the issue.
Because I've had that where people are like, we wanted to bring you on, but we figured you wouldn't want to do that. I'm like, it pays. Are you crazy? like all I do is sit at home all day long. Of course I'd want to do that.
No, I'm still getting things that I'm still getting offers for things I don't want to do.
Like this podcast. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, now we have you doing the station ID, so you're forever linked.
Let's do it again.
let's do it one more time. David, here's something I'm very curious about. When you were growing up, did you want to be a comedian?
I was like, like once I figured out what stand-up comedy was, it was like 4 or 5, I was like, this is something, I was obsessed with comedy, I wanted to do it, but I didn't think I could do it for a long time.
So that young, 4 or 5 years old?
Because we were just obsessed with comedy, because we were watching it, and I just, like, even though we didn't understand it at all, it was just the way it looked and the way it played out, it seemed like the greatest thing to be a part of.
So you're a young dude. So like what year, like what are we talking, like the early, late 80s or?
85.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, 85. Yeah. So you were seeing, that was the boom, right, exactly.
The shoulder pads.
Boom. We were watching a lot of stand-up comedy, even though we didn't understand it, we just, like, if it had a laugh track, we enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. You're into it.
So, and for some weird reason, like, stand-up comedy, like, we obsessively watched it.
Really?
And
it's like, been, you're like, talking about you and your
siblings. Yeah, my whole family, me and my 2 younger brothers, but like, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy was hands down constantly watched. And so comedy was always a thing I wanted to do. But I was never intentionally funny at all. I was just a foreign kid that just did weird things.
Like what? What was, like, you mean at school you do weird shit at school?
Oh, well, I was a weird little kid. I was a weirdo. I was a nerdy little African kid with a bit of an accent.
And you're tall when you're a kid? You're
I said stuff kid. Like, my only friends are books, which is not a thing you should say aloud as a child.
In Fresno.
Yeah.
In Fresno. You didn't get picked on, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. So they obviously laughed at me, but not for the reasons
Was it hard for you to do your first set? Like, did people have to push you on stage? Were you one of those kinds? Or were you ready to?
No. No one was the first time I did a set was, we made a bartender at this bar that we hung out laugh a lot, me and my good friend, and she was like, she demanded us to, like, she didn't like force it on us, but she's like, you guys should do a show here. and then we were like, okay. So we started working, like, we planned it out 2 months ahead. Mm-hmm. And we started working towards it, and then my friend was like, I have stage fright, like, a month in. And I was like, I get it.
A month in.
So I ended up just doing a solo show. Like, I was 25, I did a solo show for my first set, and I did 45 minutes.
Whoa.
Didn't say it was a good 45.
Yeah, no, but
you just
still
have to, and it was mostly my friends. Yeah. And, like,
wait,
that was...
Wait, what? You did 45 minutes?
Yes.
For your first show?
Yes.
Was it improvised?
No, I typed out most of it.
wow, what was it about? Like, what did you talk about for 45 minutes?
It was a lot of storytelling, a lot of weird jokes, a lot of like references. That... And the thing was that I started doing mics after that, and then I was like, I'm not gonna do another 45 minute set for a long, long time.
Is anything from that, like, is that bit about the video games?
There's nothing.
Nothing like that is in your act now.
There was barely, I barely used a minute from that 45 minute set, like a week later.
You're just like, bury this. Yeah.
That's ballsy, dude. That's awesome.
it was a venue. It was just mostly my friends. But being that overambitious made going to mics not as terrifying. I was immediately like way more comfortable being at a mic because I was like, I don't have to do 45 minutes tonight.
Right. What was the Seattle scene like then?
Seattle scene was pretty great at the time because the alt scene was really strong. A couple years new, and we had a great regular show that was at a bar called Chop Suey, and it was a really solid time to come up, and it was immediately supportive, so I didn't have any issue like getting into everything and just being a part of the world of comedy in Seattle. It was pretty dope. I can't complain.
It's awesome.
And it was supportive.
Did you ever get into the underground there?
Oh yeah, that was my home club.
That was your home club.
Yeah, okay. I would go there every week for the open mic. It's the best open mic I've ever had to endure.
You do at open mics is you endure it.
Well, that's with them the rule. Like no one, if you got bumped, you automatically got put on the next open mic.
Oh yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it definitely was also like self-regulated. Like the people that sucked eventually stopped coming, except for like the people that are just absolutely crazy, who I always wanted to come back anyway because they're the best thing in the world.
I
wish there's this entire, like the entire world will never know the greatness of the crazy people that come to open mics.
It is something the rest of like the populace of America, they don't quite understand what happens at comedy open mics.
And they shouldn't. I don't think they should ever go, other than seeing those brief moments of crazy.
I'm thinking, Paco, did you ever go to Dirty Tricks when Myron the Moron was there? Did you hear about Myron the Moron?
I only went once, and he was there, but yes.
This is another one of these guys who just did a character that had no jokes, but he would just like bang the microphone into his balls repeatedly, or like pull a fish out of his pants while wearing like a Joker or like a Riddler suit. This is the kind of thing I'm like, I wonder how that guy's doing nowadays. Like now that there's no Dirty Tricks for him to show up at anymore.
We had the commander, I don't know if he was homeless or not, but he always showed up in a different wig every week. Mm-hmm. And all of his sets were to be continued from the last set.
No way. Yes. There were cliffhanger sets?
You remember last week.
You remember last time I was here and I mentioned my friend Darnell? Well, here's the rest of that joke. And you're like, what? I can't.
Oh, oh my God.
It is truly the safety net.
It's the best. I couldn't. Oh, there's even more. And I know we're limited for time. Did you have one, Paco, that you've called?
I don't know if I can top the commander.
Oh, I'm sure there's at least one.
I mean, not really. To be quite honest, I didn't do open mics too much. I didn't go. I still don't. I can't do it. It hurts
snobby
myself.
Snobby Paco. Oh, yeah.
I can't. It makes me want to quit comedy.
I like checking in on it every once in a while.
I'm a masochist, dude. I was in like noise music for years before I did this, so it's an improvement. Right. I run a mic now at the library, we have a homeless dude who comes all the time, and he started signing up, and he tells super like homophobic, like anti-Semitic. Sure. Jokes, but I'm just like, well, it's the library. I guess it's freedom of speech. But we saw him the other day. He did like a joke like that, and then he did something that I think he wrote himself. I'm like, he was doing like street jokes, and then like he had a joke about the Beatles. I'm like, it's not good, but I feel like you wrote this. And then he'd just like do like, and now he'd tell his really awful, like, homophobic joke and be like, and now, what if Barbara Streisand did this? I'm like, you're, like, canceling yourself out
right.
by doing this.
It's very confusing. What's happening?
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
My favorite thing about, like, the open mic thing, though, is the people that you think, like, oh, man, this person, I'm not sure they have it, and then they turn that corner, mm-hmm. and you're like, fuck, man, you're fucking good now. Yeah. You know, you see them, like, a year or two later, and you're like, what the fuck happened? You're awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I also love the ones that where you get to watch somebody that's a piece of shit just fall.
Yes. Those are the ones that usually come in super cocky.
Oh, and God, like I love them.
Yeah.
I've seen a guy. I remember early on going to Brainwash. This guy came in. He was like super cocky, kind of jockey dude. And he told some jokes about Asians having small dicks. And then he left immediately afterward and had like three of his friends leave with him. And I was just like, yeah, I don't think I'll ever see that guy again. I don't think he's coming back. If he, like, just... I did it once and I left on a high. That was, like, kind of the vibe of that. Oh, man.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a fair share of fucking shitty dudes that showed up and were just like, I'm going to be here for a year and then I'm going to be gone because none of you like me.
Yeah. Seattle dudes.
Oh, God. Yeah, Seattle. Like, and there's also people like that drove out of the middle of nowhere to come to the open mic.
Right. Like I came from Yakima.
Yeah,
or
like I drove 3 hours to be at this mic. I'm like, you should have started a mic wherever you're from because it is not worth it.
No.
That stuff's amazing. The grind that some people go through, man. Like, I mean, there are mics in my neighborhood, and I'm like, I don't even want to walk over there. Like, people are driving hours to hit up places. It's insane.
And I respect them. I'm never going to do what they do, but I respect them.
Yes. A lot of respect will not do that, for sure. Which is probably, like, part of the theme to this doc, which is kind of is respect in a sense, mm-hmm. you know, not to... I'm just going to bring it back to the doc.
To the thing that we're talking about? Yeah.
The reason we're all here.
Because, like, I mean, that's ultimately what is going on through the story of this documentary is, like, is not just the talent that is getting overlooked or used, mm-hmm. but it's, like, the respect that all of these people deserve because of their talent, you know, and the grind that they put in. Mm-hmm. With that, that's why it's like it is like you were talking about, like it is a feel good documentary, but there is a little bit of that torment in here, you know.
Mm-hmm. There's that torment, but I appreciate it because it's coming to terms with your place in the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's not still, really bitter,
but realizing that you are a talent and you are a very capable and amazing, and I think that's the one great thing about each of them is that they when they reflect back on their career, they have zero regrets. Like, I'm glad I did
that.
Yeah,
that is true. Mm-hmm. It would be hard, man. Mm-hmm. Don't you think? I feel like I'm going to be one of those old, bitter comics. I'm going to look back with so much regret.
I don't think I've known any cheerful old comedian. Is there?
That's a good point.
There's not a single one.
Do you think you're going to be a bitter old comic, Solomon?
If I keep doing comedy, yes. because you're either a happier person that isn't doing comedy or a bitter comedian that's still doing comedy.
Oh, man.
Right.
Yeah. That's so true.
You just bruised George.
Well,
George is bruised.
Just like the some people are going to be really good at comedy and have no life skills. Mm-hmm. I think there's a certain number of people I think that fall into that. It's like, this is the only thing that you're capable of doing. And then it's like, if you kind of have other options, maybe explore your other options.
Yeah.
I think that's not a bad
I've heard that so much,
process.
Man.
I've heard that.
Mark Maron brings that up on his podcast all the time. Like, if you can do anything else, do it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what scares me sometimes because I'm like, I'm pretty capable. Should I even be doing this? Maybe mm-hmm. I should be managing a fucking Best Buy somewhere.
Pocket will build your WordPress for you if you pay him a certain I don't know what your fee is. I'm not going to pimp out your fee.
I will throw together a WordPress site for you. Yeah, I mean, like that's ultimately what this comes down to is like choosing that path, that career. And you're right. It's like when all of these people, they didn't talk to anyone looking back and being like, fuck that. Mm-hmm. I should never mm-hmm. have done that, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of an interesting point. I mean, if anybody had any reason to be pissed, it's Darlene Love,
yeah.
you know? Mm-hmm. And George, you brought up that piece that you read.
Right.
And what does she say?
Interview with her where they're like the writer is like, I would be way more mad at Phil Spector than you are. And she's just like, hate gives you wrinkles.
That's perfect.
It's like, yep, point, Darlene.
Yeah, that's the same. Martha Wash is the same way, too. She mm-hmm. could have been upset from being like her voice being covered and mm-hmm. replaced by models. Mm-hmm. But she was like, you know what? Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, she still thanked Phil. I mean, she still, like, Darlene still thanked Phil Spector in the end, because it's like he, you know, thank you to him for making me part of his wall of sound, you know?
Yeah. But I personally, I will hate him forever. For
yeah,
her.
He's done a lot of terrible things.
I'll take her wrinkles on
a lot
for
of
her.
People. Yeah.
Yeah. Those wigs alone, Phil.
Yeah.
Someone should have intervened with the wig thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. I don't know what's his thing. What's his mental thing? What's his breakdown?
He loves guns. That's
one
thing.
The thing is, like, when you live a certain lifestyle where you do a lot of drugs and you have a lot of people saying yes to you and mm-hmm. pampering you when not telling you that you're a monster and you should behave better.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. This film was distributed by the Weinstein Company. Also, bring it back.
Speaking of which, yeah. Yes. Well, shit, man. So I don't know. I think there is. I mean, it's a beautifully told documentary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I enjoyed watching it because I love this music so much. But I mean, there is something about getting into a career where you have no idea what's about to happen. And you can't plan that shit. Mm-hmm. There's no corner office yeah. when you get promoted in the entertainment world, you know?
You get called at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
in your slippers to come out and work with the biggest rock
and
band.
Do the greatest hook of yeah. all time.
Yeah.
All fucking time. Yeah.
Like, no one can match that.
No. Yeah.
Lisa Fisher comes close. Yes. That's the only one. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I think, Solomon, I think we're at our end.
Oh. That was a really good time. I loved talking about this. It was yeah. such a. I love this documentary so much. I'm glad you guys watched it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for bringing it. It was great to see it again. And best of luck with your next writing gig.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Or whatever I'm doing.
And whatever happens to you.
You want
to
plug
your
records?
Oh, yes. I do have an album, Homo Negro Superior, that's available on Comedy Central Records via iTunes, Amazon, Google Playlist, whatever you want to find. Yeah, it probably is. Or Spotify. It's everywhere. And that is where you'll hear me do an hour.
And then what's a Comedy Central? Is it a half hour?
The special is a half hour. That's things on the Comedy Central app as well, so mm-hmm. that's viewable still.
Right on.
And we'll be listening for Backing Up the Punch
mm-hmm.
in the next
yes,
year
yes,
or two.
Yes,
right?
Yes, 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 yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Rape, get Lisa murder.
All right. Those are the topics we're going to talk about tonight.
All right. Thanks a lot, Solomon.
Thanks, Solomon.
Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scoble.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.